Nobody can be too Jewish.
That's exactly it. You got it.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is Eshkol Nevo, the best-selling Israeli novelist whose new book is called Three Floors Up. We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, our Two Jewish Mavenah in Israel, Oshrat Barel, and our Shinchinim, Chen Dinachi, and Tamir Shakuri. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. I've been thinking lately about a problem that all non-fundamentalist religious traditions have in the world today. It's a question that's interested me for a couple of decades. At its heart, it comes down to this. If you don't believe that the core of your religion was given to you directly by God, what authority do the rules and traditions of your faith actually have? In other words, if God isn't the source of your religion and the texts it's based on, why should anyone follow it? Now, if you do believe that God directly gave your religion and its holy books, then this isn't a problem. Orthodox Jews believe God gave not only the Ten Commandments to Moses on Mount Sinai, but the rest of the Torah and the entirety of the Hebrew Bible as well. They don't have to ask where the authority behind Jewish law comes from. It's directly from God. And even the odd complexities of halacha, the Jewish legal codes that develop from the rules in the Torah, can be justified as human beings simply seeking to derive additional meaning from the original words of the Lord. If you are a deeply believing Christian who sees the New Testament as the Word of God and views Jesus' statements as divine, it's not difficult to see that the authority for your religion and its rules and customs also comes directly from God. If you are a Muslim and believe Muhammad was the last prophet and spoke directly to Allah, his teachings and laws would also have divine authority derived from God. The same would hold true for those Hindus who believe their scriptural texts come directly from the gods. But what do you do for authority if you don't believe your whole religion and its holy texts was given directly by God? If you say, my religion tells me we must do this, or my religious tradition informs me that we can't do that, but you don't think those rules are based on divine authority, well, what are you basing your decisions on? A simple example. It's easy if you're an Orthodox Jew or rabbi to say you mustn't work on Shabbat because God commands we take a day off each week. Give our families and employees a day off too. Saturday is for prayer and study and family only. It's in the Torah. But if you are a liberal, progressive, pluralistic, that is, non-Orthodox Jew, that doesn't work. It's not sufficient that the Torah says so. You have to explain. We all need time off for rest and rejuvenation. It's an essential human need. It's one of Judaism's greatest inventions, the notion we should work hard but take a break from it too. Shabbat is wonderful, lovely, the way that we reconnect with those we love weekly. So shut off your cell phones, detach from social media. Don't work or watch TV. Go to temple. Make this a spiritual time for everyone in your household. All of that's true and wonderful, but also much trickier to support. Because instead of a straightforward answer, it came from God who knows best always, you now have to spend a lot of time justifying it in terms of human needs and capacities, knowing that there will be objections based on contrasting human needs and capacities. And what do you do about the Shabbat rules that say you can't travel or light a fire or drive if those make life too complicated and less enjoyable? You have to change them or ignore them. That becomes, well, increasingly complicated. Which means that intellectually, in an odd way, it's simpler to just accept orthodoxy or fundamentalism. The practice part, the religious doing, is generally much harder when you do that. But you have to spend a lot less time thinking about and justifying why you do what you do and why you don't do what you don't do. I'm not saying it's simpler to be a more Orthodox Jew, Christian, Muslim, or Hindu. The many religious requirements and prohibitions make it very challenging, but you don't have to spend much time worrying about your own authenticity. On the other hand, there are times when a more fundamentalist view of religion doesn't help us understand morality at all. Authentic these codes may be, but sometimes they are simply inadequate. This issue has come out recently in the explosive revelations of sexual harassment and exploitation of women and young men by powerful and sometimes famous men. It hit first in the entertainment industry with producers and directors like Harvey Weinstein and many others, spread to actors and comedians with the Kevin Spacey and Louis C.K. exposures, and now has moved into politics with Judge Roy Moore and others. Everybody understands this is terrible stuff. That people in positions of power appear to have exploited their status and control to abuse non-consenting adults, and apparently children as well. It's ugly and awful. But when we examine why we think it's awful, we come away realizing that most religious traditions don't really prohibit such behaviors, short of actual rape. There isn't anything about exploiting a power relationship for immoral purposes in the Jewish, Christian, or Islamic codes. Adultery, as defined in the Ten Commandments, and both the Old and New Testaments, was considered only to be sex with a woman who was married or engaged to somebody else. That is, a married man who had sex with an unmarried woman wasn't committing adultery. While all three religious codes condemn homosexuality, which most contemporary American Jews and Christians at least do not believe is morally objectionable, none of them really address coercion. That doesn't mean that we think it's okay to do any of this. It's wrong. We know it's wrong, and feel it viscerally in our kishkas, our guts. But it does mean that no matter how authentic a religious tradition is, it is not likely to be fully adequate by itself to the requirements of a contemporary society. And in order to figure out what it really is that God wants in this world, you have to use not only the deep religious tradition you inherit or adopt, but your own mind, heart, and soul. To play us in this morning, here's a wonderful melody from a past guest of Too Jewish, master Sephardic musicologist and performer Gerard Ederi, called Kochav Tzedek, Righteous Star, about the virtues of our ancestor Abraham. Kochav Tzedek L'dorot Tzarahoro Echad Ha'haya Avraham Bivnei Dohoro Asher ba'aviv shenotav hikir yotzro Vayar sham vimor otav et mishtar Kochav tzedek l'dorot tzarahoro Echad ha'haya Avraham bivnei dohoro Asher ba'aviv shenotav hikir yotzro Vayar sham vimorotav et mishtar Zakan yoshev bishiva lo sar tzava Ve'im shorfe charavot zichro lova Ach lahakil kehilot nafshot tava Ulelam damet likho mideho vru Kochav tzedek ledorot tzarahoro Echad ha'haya Avraham bivnei dohoro Asher ba'aviv shenotav hikir yotzro Vayar sham vimorotav et mishtaro
קפצתי סם את חרבם שם לגפה.
That was Kochav Tzedek, Righteous Star, by Sephardic singer-scholar Gerard Edry. Our guest this morning is the outstanding Israeli novelist Eshkol Nivo, whose new book is called Three Floors Up. We'll explore what's so different and interesting about contemporary Israeli literature when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
Do you know someone who personally made a major difference for the whole Jewish people? An individual who's done important work for Klal Yisrael and deserves to be highly recognized for that effort. As president of the Kohan Memorial Foundation, I'm grateful that the modest cash awards we started more than 10 years ago have grown into a substantial amount of unrestricted funds given to winners, with the help of donors like many of you. The foundation, named for my grandparents, Rabbi Samuel S. Kohan and Irma Kohan, makes these awards for important service to Klal Yisrael, the entire Jewish people. That service can be in one of four activities: unity, education, creative arts, or rescue. Past Kohan Award recipients are remarkable people who've done outstanding work. If you know someone who qualifies for a Kohan Foundation Award, please go to kohanaward.com, kohanaward.com, and fill out the simple nomination form. That website is kohanaward.com. Nominate an individual or donate yourself. Do it for the whole Jewish people.
We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning. Eshkol Nivo is a very successful Israeli novelist who also runs the most successful creative writing school in Israel. His books have been nominated for a variety of prizes. His new book is called Three Floors Up, which I think personally is extraordinary. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Good morning.
So let's talk kind of more broadly about Israeli writing. There have been many great Israeli writers. There's a change in the way Israeli novels are now. They seem somehow fresher and more homegrown, where in the early days of Israeli literature, you had Agnon, you had people deeply steeped in a religious background, even if they weren't religious. That's not the flavor of your writing today, is it?
Well, you have all sorts of writers in Israel. You still have Agnonic kind of writers, even from my generation. Every writer has his own tendencies and is a world of itself, but I can speak about my writing. It's definitely influenced by the fact that I was born in the 70s. So I read modern literature. I saw films. I think all my generation writers are deeply affected from the rhythm of films and the rhythm of music, which it has changed. So It's for the readers to say, and I wonder how you felt, but yes, I feel my books are kind of a reflection of the rhythm that current Israel is living in.
I think in Three Floors Up, which by the way is sort of three somewhat interconnected stories set in one Tel Aviv suburban apartment building, it has a, I don't know, each story is different and reflects a different voice, but each feels very contemporary. You know, you include in the last section, I think you include a whole segment on the Israeli, the cottage cheese protests, the social protests that have been going on, went on for summers. So it's very fresh, and yet it feels uniquely Israeli somehow. This isn't a book that could have been written about London or Paris, or New York, and I think that's, yet it has a universality, a human universality to it. That might be too vague, but
no, actually, you know, it's an interesting experience because my books have been translated to many languages, and I'm book touring around the world for 10 years now. I can say that every book of mine, I feel, is deeply Israeli until right. I'm starting the book tour. And then I get Italians tell me that, for instance, in Three Floors Up, the first floor, what I think is a very Israeli guy, Arnon, worried about what happened to his daughter while she was on a babysitter. I think Arnon is extremely Israeli, but my Italian readers thought he's an Italian man. He's a classic Italian man. and I get people in Greece talking with me about the second floor and women and telling me this is a Greek, a very Greek woman, her feelings, the way she thinks about motherhood. So again and again, I'm surprised to see how something that I, of course, write local becomes global.
And maybe that's just the quality of good writing, is that it becomes universal. We will talk much more with Eshkol Nivo about his book, Three Floors Up, a terrific new novel, when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or a kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's twojewishradio18@gmail. Or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular podcasts, top 10 Jewish podcast in America, according to Moment magazine. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Tom, you're recently back from Israel, and I know you don't like to talk about Israel, usually, because there's so many other Jewish places in the world. But one of the fascinating parts about Israel is what a diverse place it has become.
Right. And the part of Israel that I don't like to talk about is Israeli internal politics.
Yes.
And all of its, like, crazy political parties and crazy
corruption,
politicians, and whatever. That's the part I don't like to talk
about. Okay, I promise we won't talk about that.
Good. So the reason for this trip, which is actually the second one I made this year, unusual for me, is that it was the 50th reunion of the very first time I visited Israel as a kid, right after the Six-Day War in June 1967. And for everybody, that was a magical summer. I mean, the moment we were there, Israel was full of euphoria and optimism. Nobody foresaw in any way, shape, or form the problems that tripling the national territory overnight was going to cause. And the Israeli Arabs, both pre-1967 Arabs and post-1967 Arabs, were so stunned by this that they were just like, eager to please their new masters. I mean, they just sort of didn't cause any problems to anybody in any way, shape, or form. That's obviously changed a lot since, although much less with Arabs who are from pre-1967 Israel and much less with Christian Arabs than with Muslim Arabs.
So, I mean, we want to make a distinction. They're often called Israeli Arabs. They're citizens of Israel. They vote. They pay taxes.
They serve as judges and parliamentarians and doctors and every possible role that you can think of.
In the police force and everything else, right.
So what I was happy to see on this trip was how even socially and commercially, the Arabs living in pre-1967 Israel in particular are totally integrated. And there's this popular image in the United States that people have of Israel as, so, quote unquote, an apartheid nation.
Well, not just the United States, obviously all over Europe.
Well, but we're not talking about that
okay.
right now. So, I mean, it's fine, all over the world maybe. But right now we're not talking about perceptions of Israel in India. I'm talking about your listeners who are mostly, as far as I know, in the U.S.
Mostly indeed.
Okay, so the perception that these people are somehow in internment camps or whatever is just totally off base. Whenever you go to a bar or a club or a cafe or a restaurant in Jerusalem or in Tel Aviv, you will see Israeli Arabs, and they will be speaking Arabic with their families or their friends.
And I might add, in Haifa, it might be even more obvious.
Right. That's a place I never go. But, I was in Jerusalem, the old first Ottoman railway station that used to connect like Cairo to Jerusalem,
to
Beirut, right, or Damascus, yeah, or whatever, and ultimately back to the motherland in Turkey, that Ottoman railway station has been transformed into a whole area of cafes and restaurants and whatever, and that is probably a third of the people there at any given moment are Arabs.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's probably shocking for many foreigners, if they open their ears and can actually distinguish between Hebrew and Arabic, to realize how fully integrated Arab citizens of Israel are in every aspect of life. Maybe next week we can also talk about the diversity of other populations, people of other origins, which is growing by leaps and bounds.
Absolutely, and I think it might have some useful, instructive purposes for us here in America. Thanks, Tom. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
We welcome our Mivi Nahr, expert on Israel, head of the Weintraub Israel Center, Oshrat Barel. Boker Tov, Oshrat.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
You know, you read a really interesting book recently. The title is a play on Joseph Heller's Catch-22 about how, you know, some things you just can't get out of. It's about the conflict in Israel. Tell us about it.
Yeah, so, yeah, the book was written by Micha Goodman. He's a historian. And if I remember right, he even lives in itnachluyot, in the, how do you call it? Territories?
In the territories, yeah.
Yehuda Veshomron, Shtachim, you know, there is a lot of way to describe this, and it the way you choose to say it, it's like reflect your political approach.
It's either Greater Israel or Judea and Samaria, yeah, or it's the occupied territories, or
you
it's
know.
Occupied Palestine, it's all the same place.
Yes, and the idea, he wrote this book, and he really gives the reader an opportunity to see the two different, sides, I would say, both sides of the conflict, but from a very, very, I would say, historian background, and goes back hundreds of years in order to understand the current state of mind. Because sometimes we, like I would say myself, I'll go back to, you know, 47, maybe 48, maybe, you know, beginning of the, you know...
Or certainly 1967.
Yes, maybe Balfour Statement.
Right?
But
Balfour,
that's it.
The
yeah, Balfour Declaration. But
right.
That's it, you know. But he really takes us back to, you know, really understand the Arab ego or the Arab pride, and really understand why, you know, based on what this pride was and what they lost, like during the centuries, and for what countries, and then to understand why they, I would say, hate or against or resist to, you know, countries like to the West in general, because they took their place as the inventors and, you know,
and innovators and the ones, you know,
yes,
leaders
really,
in science and technology,
yes,
right?
You know, yeah, in terms of, you know, the empire time to compare
from the time the Ottoman Empire moving up to now, it's obviously a very different status for the Arab world.
Yes, and then and that's one side of the conflict, and then on the other side, with understanding the Jewish Israeli state of mind based on the very, very old fear of being wiped out, you know, as a Jewish state. Bechol dor kamim aleinu lechalotenu, kind
yeah,
of.
And every generation they've come against us to destroy us, right?
Yes, and
like
that's what.
Seder.
Yeah, and it doesn't surprise, because one of the very, very main thing that Israel, like the Israeli or the Israeli side, will demand is that the Arab will acknowledge our right to exist as a Jewish state.
Right. Right.
And it's no wonder, you know, that's represent this fear. It's a very important book, and I had a very few minutes to describe it, but maybe we can talk about it again.
Let's talk about it and continue this next week. The title of the book is interesting. I don't think it's been translated to English yet, but the title is basically Catch 67, you know, based on the 1967 war and the occupied territories coming into Israel in 67. Fascinating. We'll continue this discussion next week. Thanks, Oshrat.
Thank you.
When we return, we'll get the old Jewish joke of the week.
Hi, Doris. How are you?
Well, Carol, to be honest, now that I'm a little older, I can't get out as much as I'd like. I miss seeing people.
Why don't you come over to my place for lunch on us? The food's delicious. So many choices. And I have a special table with my friends every day. They'd love to have you join us.
Is there much to do there?
There are lots of activities every day. Mondays is Mahjong. Tuesdays, I do yoga. Wednesdays, we go shopping or to the museum or a restaurant. Thursdays, my exercise class. There are book groups, speakers, Shabbos services, concerts, a game room. I'm busier than ever.
Where do you live?
I'm at Handmaker. And the people are great. Please come over for lunch. You'll love it. It's even kosher. Just call me at 322-7035.
Handmaker Jewish Services for the Aging offers the full spectrum of quality senior living and post-hospital rehabilitative care. Call 322-7035. Handmaker for life. 322-7035.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie New, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Yossi comes home from school and tells his mother he's been given a part in the school play. Wonderful, says his mother. And what part is it? Yossi says, I play the part of the Jewish husband. But his mother scowls and says, go back. Tell your teacher you want a speaking part. That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. The urge to journey out into the unknown is a major motivation in the Torah. We saw it with Abraham a few weeks ago. We find it in the lives of most of our ancestors, and we encounter it perhaps most powerfully in the story of this week's great Torah portion of Vayetze. At the start of the tale, Jacob is fleeing his brother Esau's potential revenge for cheating him out of both birthright and blessing. He leaves his family and his home, both of which are in Beersheba in Canaan, and journeys towards Haran, Abraham's adopted hometown. Haran is located just north of the current Syrian border in eastern Turkey, near Şanlıurfa, between the Tigris and Euphrates rivers, the cradle of civilization. I visited there during my sabbatical trip 2 years ago. Haran was filled then with refugees from the Syrian civil war. 3,700 years ago, when Jacob headed there, Haran was an important city-state in ancient Syria, and Abraham's family still lived there. But first, Jacob had to get to Haran. He was ill-prepared for the journey. Leaving Beersheba, he has nothing with him at all, in fact, not even a bedroll, and at night he's forced to lay his head on a rock to sleep. In this state of extremis, God brings him a promise in the form of a famous dream. A ladder going up to heaven, angels ascending and descending in a pledge of family and land and ultimate safety and security. Jacob, our forefather, wakes from the dream and says pointedly, hey, God was in this place and I didn't know it. That's something all of us can say from time to time, isn't it? For God is in every place and we often don't realize it. Here in Vayetze, Jacob's exclamation provides us with an incredible message of awareness from the true father of our people. But there's another important message in Vayetze. It is that Jacob must leave everything familiar in order to allow him to find God's presence. Throughout human history, religions are founded by individuals who leave ordinary lives and places and wander off into the wilderness, usually the desert. Abraham, Jacob, and Moses are the most obvious Jewish pioneers. Buddha, Jesus, and Muhammad fit the same pattern. In order to become whom we seek to be spiritually, we must begin by leaving what we already know. And then, when we encounter God in the wilderness, we learn God was back there at home too. We just weren't yet ready to notice that. If we're lucky and aware, we will come to realize God is in this place, indeed, in every place. All we have to do is to go out into the wilderness for a little, open our eyes, and accept that fact. When we return on to Jewish, our guest, Eshkol Nivo, best-selling Israeli novelist, author of the outstanding new novel Three Floors Up, will discuss what makes great writing in Hebrew and in English. Find out when we come back in a moment right here on Too Jewish.
Is your aging loved one unhappy and having a hard time adjusting to life around them? The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker may be able to help. TMC Geropsych specializes in providing short-term inpatient services for older adults experiencing behavioral health issues. Did you know that most people with depression get better when they seek help? With the right treatment, those with anxiety can overcome and learn to cope with their fears, and individuals with dementia can continue leading quality lives. Our team, led by a geriatric psychiatrist, brings expertise from disciplines across a variety of specialties to ensure your loved one receives the right diagnosis and treatment. For more information about our services, please call 324-4600. The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker. Call 324-4600. Let's talk about how we can help.
We continue with our Two Jewish Update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
While the wave of attempts to delegitimize Israel on college campuses through divestment resolutions has waned in the U.S., last week the University of Michigan student government voted to form a committee to urge the Michigan administration to divest from companies doing business with Israel. This small propaganda victory for the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions movement, the BDS movement, which is largely funded and organized by Arab oil states, by the way, is a disappointment for those of us who know it to be an anti-Israel and often truly anti-Semitic effort to demonize the only true democracy in the Middle East. This was the 11th attempt to have the student government of Michigan embrace divestment, but the first to have a secret ballot and deliberately keep some pro-Israel speakers out of the debate. It is very unlikely the University of Michigan will follow the student government's directive. No university has ever divested from Israel or Israeli-tied companies as a result of a BDS campaign. Michigan University President Mark Schlissel has stated his opposition to the BDS movement, saying that it's the wrong thing to do whether you agree or disagree with the politics and decisions made in any country. Still, it's disappointing, symbolically painful, and sad. In other news, in his video address to the Jewish Federation's General Assembly in D.C. last week, Israeli Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu said that he was fully committed to the establishment of an egalitarian prayer space at the Western Wall, which very few people believe, and then revealed that Israel had offered humanitarian assistance to Iranian and Iraqi earthquake victims via the Red Cross, which everyone should believe. Now, first, the aid to earthquake victims. 7.3 magnitude earthquake struck the border between Iraq and Iran last week, killing over 500 people, injuring 7,500 more, leaving tens of thousands homeless. Neither Iran nor Iraq recognizes Israel. Iran immediately rejected Israeli aid. It has rejected all offers of foreign assistance. It seems unlikely Iraq will accept Israeli aid either, but while this was a typical Bibi Netanyahu grandstand play, it is deeply grounded in Israeli emergency efforts all around the world in places with humanitarian needs, regardless of ideology. Israel has a long and distinguished track record of providing emergency help to countries suffering natural disasters. Recently, Israeli emergency teams were critical in helping Mexico after recent earthquakes and in Nepal after its devastating earthquakes 2 years ago. Now, as to Netanyahu fully supporting the creation of an egalitarian prayer space at the Western Wall, the Kotel, well, there was a full agreement in place, negotiated by no less a human hero than Natan Sharansky, and it was ready to go into construction about a year and a half ago, but Netanyahu's government wimped out. He pretended it needed more study. It never happened, all because of ultra-Orthodox pressure. So don't believe Netanyahu on this one at all. Back here in America, just when you think things can't get any weirder in the political world, something trumps what has preceded it. Last week, a made-up reporter named Bernie Bernstein called an Alabama pastor in search of women to provide damaging remarks about Republican Senate candidate Roy Moore, who has been accused of sexual contact with minors. In the robocall, the man left a voicemail message with Pastor Al Moore claiming to be a reporter for the Washington Post and offering women money in exchange for allegations which he said would not be well vetted. The caller's Jewish-sounding name and northeastern accent prompted accusations of anti-Semitism. Hi, this is Bernie Bernstein. I'm a reporter for the Washington Post, calling to find out if anybody at this address is a female between the ages of 54 to 57 years old, willing to make damaging remarks about candidate Roy Moore for a reward of between $5,000 and $7,000. We will not be fully investigating these claims. However, we'll make a written report. I can be reached by email at albernstein@washingtonpost.com. Thank you. Yeah. Marty Baron, the Washington Post executive editor, who is Jewish, criticized the call as an attempt to undermine his newspaper. No kidding. No staffer at the Post is named Bernie Bernstein or Al Bernstein. The call's description of our reporting methods bears no relationship to reality, Baron said. We are shocked and appalled. Anyone would stoop to this level to discredit real journalism. Yeah. The Washington Post broke the story about allegations by four women that Roy Moore made romantic or sexual overtures to them when they were teenagers and he was in his 30s. One said Moore initiated an encounter, a sexual encounter with her in 1979 when she was 14 years old and he was 32. Another woman accused Moore of sexually assaulting her in the late 70s when she was 16 and showed reporters a flattering message from Moore in her high school yearbook. The New Yorker reported that many people in Moore's hometown of Gadsden, Alabama, recalled him being barred from the local mall for bothering young women. Roy Moore, who is 70, is a former prosecutor and judge. He has denied the allegations. He told supporters at a campaign rally in Huntsville, Alabama, that the Washington Post was attacking him for political reasons, and he threatened to sue the newspaper. Moore's wife claims that the women were paid by her husband's critics to accuse him and posted false news reports as purported evidence. A number of prominent Republicans have called on Moore to withdraw from the Senate race, including Senate Leader Mitch McConnell and House Leader Paul Ryan.
There's an attack coming from far away.
Not coming, Bruce. It's already here.
The new superhero movie, The Justice League, is out now, and while it, like most such exercises, is kind of stupid, Gal Gadot, the Israeli model and movie star, is pretty much the best part of the film. The premise, oh, who really cares about the premise of a superhero movie? Well, anyway, the premise is that there are five comic book heroes with extraordinary powers who come together to defeat an attack on Earth by evil aliens. It's notable that along with Gal Gadot as Wonder Woman, the star who plays The Flash is Ezra Miller, who is also Jewish. Apparently, it takes 40% Jewish superheroes to save the world. Who knew? And GQ magazine has just named Gal Gadot its Woman of the Year, rebranding the award as Wonder Woman of the Year. Mazel tov. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Around the World. We welcome back to Two Jewish, our guest this morning. Novelist Eshkol Neva was born in Jerusalem in 1971. He studied an interesting combination, copywriting at the Tirza Granot School and psychology at Tel Aviv University. That's quite a combination.
Yeah, confusing years because I was working in an advertising agency, a cynical world, and then I was going to my psychology studies and practice also. So I was moving from one world to another, and at the end, both worlds were not really the worlds I wanted to be in, so I started writing, and that's how I became a novelist.
Your novels have been bestsellers in Israel, Homesick, I was a finalist for an important prize, World Cup Wishes, and Neuland, which is about 2014, and then this book now, Three Floors Up, which we started to talk about at the beginning of the show. Where do you get your ideas? How do you decide that something's going to be a novel instead of a short story? How did you come up with Three Floors Up?
Well, it's a funny story because this book started with my license, my driving license was suspended for 3 months because I did I was speaking on the cellular while driving, and don't try this at home. Don't try this at car. and I ended up using public transportation in Israel, which is quite an experience because the Israelis, and this is what I found out after a couple of days, they talk on the cellular phone really loudly when they are on public transportation.
Oh, yes, they do. I can speak for that.
Stories.
Yes.
Yeah. So I, after, you know, a week in on trains, I understood that this is a gold mine, a gold mine of good stories. You know, I heard men deserted by their girlfriends live on the train, on the phone, and family disputes and military operations, and everything was out in the open. I was just sitting there listening and collecting the stories to my next book. So this is actually how I started thinking about this whole idea of confessions and privacy and the thin line between private and public. What do we keep a secret to ourselves, and who do we confess to? That was actually the starting point.
You're our storyteller. That's obvious in your writing. I guess all good novelists really are storytellers. In Three Floors Up, you adopt three different voices. One is what I would characterize as a very typical kind of Israeli, pretty macho guy. The second story is told from a mother of young children in a complicated emotional situation. And then the third is a retired woman judge. Do you enjoy adopting different voices?
Definitely. You know, yesterday was Halloween here in New York, and people wearing costumes, and I thought about it. It's quite the same. You know, I'm wearing a costume. I enjoy being someone else. It's also eye-opening for a man to be a woman while writing, or for a young man to be an older character or a child. I think maybe in this book I found it extremely easy to be the characters. It was not a tough project. It was a tough mission. Very quickly I could find them in myself. The only exception I would say was the judge, not because of her age or because she's a woman, but because she's a judge. And I don't really know how judges feel or think, and I don't have judges in my family. So this was the only point in the writing process I had to stop. I had to stop and do research to find out, for instance, do judges, when they come home and there's a dispute between the children, do they rule? Do they have a verdict even when they are off duty? So this was maybe the toughest of the three characters. Right.
You know, of the judges I know, I think some of them are the most permissive parents I've ever met. But that's
really?
A story. Yeah. Isn't that interesting? Might be a story for another time. Each of the characters, really all of the characters, I think, in Three Floors Up, have a great sense of loneliness to me in reading it, and a certain sense of loss. Is that because sad people make better characters? Or is that, was that an intentional effort in your book?
It's a wonderful question. I'm not sure I have the full answer. But I think specifically in this book, the issue is that they have a secret. Every one of these characters have a secret, and
right.
For different reasons, they cannot share their secret. They cannot confess to people that they are close to. So in a way, when you have a secret, this burden, and you cannot share it with people who are close to you, it makes you lonely. So Arnon chooses to confess to his writer friend, which is not really a good friend, and Fanny chooses to write a letter to her ex-best friend living in Connecticut. And Dvorah actually confesses to her dead husband, which is very lonely to do. And it's a very lonely act. And so I think in this specific book, these are people who are looking who to share with their deepest drives, fears, and dreams.
When these secrets come out and they sort of emerge painfully in very different ways in each of the stories, because the voices are so different, there's serious consequences, sometimes avoidable, sometimes not avoidable. You imply them. You don't necessarily hammer them home. Was that a deliberate choice?
I think It's you're asking also about how loose are the endings, right? Like are you sure as a reader what really happened and what will happen?
Right, you're not really.
It's always a dilemma.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's always a dilemma as when you come to endings, and in this book there's the ending of every floor and there's the ending of the book. It's always a dilemma whether you are giving a kind of a perfect ending, a happy ending, this kind of ending that makes readers feel that life is much less chaotic than they experience, and on the other hand, when you do an open ending, or at least when you open a couple of possibilities, you get readers troubled, like my readers in Israel, because it's a very open-hearted and speaking society. Sometimes they come to my readings to complain. A list of complaints, like, why didn't you tell us what happened in there?
Yeah, we want to know.
You want to know. But actually, when someone comes to my reading, and specifically, now I'm talking about Neuland, which is another novel of mine, who has a very open ending. And if people come to a reading of mine in Israel, 6 years after the book has been published, and they are troubled, they came to the reading to complain about the ending and to find out what really happened. And maybe it's not such a bad thing. You know, literature and art should also trouble us and open us opportunities to reflect and to project. So, yes, I think I'm leaving some points for interpretation in three floors up.
I love the ambiguity, actually. It challenges, but you're never, for example, in the middle story, you're not really sure if it really happened, and then it becomes clearer in the third story that maybe it did really happen. In the first story, you're not sure what the disastrous implications are going to be, and then in the third story, you begin to get a sense. It's really nice. Who influenced you the most in your creative writing? What authors have you looked to, or which ones have influenced the way that you write?
I think every book has its own influences, and more influenced than from specific books than from specific writers. For instance, when I was writing Neuland, I was influenced by the Plot Against America, which is
Philip Roth, right? Yeah, great book.
Yeah. And
now I have a question. Why didn't they make that into a movie instead of the Philip Roth books they've made into movies? That'd be a much better movie.
It's a good question. And you know, maybe now in the era that America is in and in the world, maybe it's a very good
be fantastic.
It's like a zeitgeist.
Yeah.
It should be a movie.
Absolutely zeitgeist.
So I was, because Neuland is about alternative history, I was really influenced by Philip Roth books. And when I was writing Homesink, I was influenced by a book by Amos Oz, which is called The Same Sea, which is a beautiful combination of prose and poetry I was really looking up to. And Three Floors Up, actually, I think in the back of my mind, there's this book by Albert Camus called The Fall. I don't know how it's called in English, but it's a guy confessing in a bar in Amsterdam about something he really, really problematic that he has done. So I think in the back of my mind, I had this book like giving me the rhythm.
And that's, of course, the first story is really that kind of a confession, a guy telling his army buddy all about, you know, this great and awful secret. I do think a little bit about you do read a little bit like Amos Oz in some of his novels, some of the depth of character kind of emerging. Who do you like today among other Israeli writers?
First of all, it's a big compliment what you said. Amos Oz was my teacher. I learned a lot from him. He was extremely generous and thoughtful as a teacher. The way he so seriously read texts of students in our class. It was an amazing experience. Actually, I learned from him how to be a teacher, not only how to be a writer. And I love to read a lot. There's a lot of good literature written in Israel. I think most of the names would not be known to your listeners, but we have marvelous writers in Israel. Beginning with, I did mention Tzvuya Shalev, which is a magnificent writer in Israel. We have Yaniv Itzkovich, is a new writer who writes very, very kind of agnonic, too Jewish, too Jewish literature, and which I think is beautiful. We have, of course, Edgar Keret, which is,
by the way, a past guest of Two Jewish.
Very, very special way of
very unique writer. Yeah, very different.
Yeah, he looks at reality with surreal glasses. So it's always fascinating. He rarely publishes in Hebrew. Like once he has a book once in a 10 year, once in a decade, and I immediately buy the book, and I'm curious to know what he's been up to. So, and of course there's Israeli cinema and Israeli music. I think a writer is influenced by many kind of arts, all sorts.
The book is called Three Floors Up. It's a great read. By the way, a fast read also, which isn't always true with translated novels, but it's just an excellent book from Eshkol Nivo. Where can people go to find out more about you and about your work?
I'm not a guy with a website, and I'm not a guy with a Facebook page. I guess they will have to read the book.
So go to Amazon and buy the book is the best advice we could give. I did have one final question. In working with a translator, your book has been translated into a variety of languages. Is it a difficult, a positive process, complicated process?
Well, it depends on the translator. I was extremely lucky, and I am extremely lucky with my English translator. Her name is Sondra Silverstone, and she is amazing. She translates like she is in my heart, and she listens to my heartbeats. The best test is when I do readings, and this is the moment when I really know whether translation is good or not. And I've been book touring now in the United States for a week and doing readings, and it's the music is so close to the original. I sometimes even forget that I'm reading
not reading your own words.
So I'm very lucky, but it's not always like this. And also there are languages that I don't really know if the translation is good or not.
Sure.
I had good and bad translators, and usually it takes time in a language I cannot read. I can read English and Spanish and Arabic, but other languages like Italian, it can take time to find out whether the translation is good or not.
I want to thank Eshkol Nivo for a great visit here on Two Jewish. Three Floors Up is a novel everybody should read, and we look forward to talking again sometime. Thank you so much.
I want to thank you for this conversation. I have to confess, it's a book about confession, so I have a confession also. It's my first radio interview in the United States about this book, and everything is new, and this. Your questions and this conversation was eye-opening, and so thank you.
You're very welcome. We could say Shehechianu too.
When we come back on Two Jewish.
Mishukuach.
Baruch Tiyeh.
When we come back on Two Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical playout.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Two Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday on Two Jewish. We'll have a special show on Thanksgiving weekend. Our guest will be two of the stars of the outstanding new TV show from Amazon called The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. Actors Rachel Brosnahan and Michael Ziegen. It's the best new TV show I've seen in a very long time and one of the best I've ever seen from the creators of The Gilmore Girls.
Don't miss these two wonderful guests next Sunday. And of course, listen to all of our podcasts on iTunes or twojewishradio.com website, top 10 Jewish podcasts in America. Our playout this morning on Two Jewish comes from Gerard Ettery as well. Why not? It's the Sephardic classic Scalarica del Oro, A Little Ladder of Gold. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a good Thanksgiving, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Novia no tiene dinero. La novia no tiene dinero.
Sponsored by Two Jewish Radio Programs, Tucson, Arizona.